I was going to say, why don't you just tell us a little bit of the basic biographical info, like your name and where you're from.
Okay. My name is Michael Bemis, and I was brought up in the high Andes of Peru because my father was a mining engineer. Was born in 1938, actually in Beloit, Wisconsin, because my mother would come back to the States to have her babies. And then we would go back to Peru when I was 3 months old when I went back. And so I grew up there. I was 14, and my brother and I then came back to the United States to high school, Tucson, Arizona, public school. And the next year we went to a military academy, which is a private school. My brother stayed there the rest of his high school career. We were in the same grade, even though he was 2.5 years older, because we didn't have a school in Peru. When I was down there, well, we didn't have a school right away. We finally had a school. We were taught in English and Spanish. Spanish is my native language, along with English. The next year, my sister had to come back to the United States for eye treatment or something and live with her grandmother, and my father wanted one of us two to stay there with my grandmother, and he had a house out in California. So I went to my junior year in California, the Bay Area. And then the fourth year, when we went back to Peru, my brother and I, and my sister, my father said, well, one of you two can go to school in England if you want to. I got a bonus, and I'll send you over to England. And my brother would have nothing to do with it. I said, oh, sure. So that would have been my fourth high school. Basically, it was a private school. They call them public schools in England. And I was there for a year and a half, and I came back to the United States too late to enter college, really. So I entered college that fall in 1957. I went to Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois for 4 years to get my bachelor's degree. Graduated in 61. I came to Wisconsin to graduate school because I don't know, because it was good in American literature, and I thought I was going to be an American literature teacher. Well, I was here a year, and then I managed to get into the Peace Corps, and Kennedy's Peace Corps. 61 to 62, I was here. Then 62, I had training at Cornell, and then I was sent to Peru, and I ran a medical post for 2 years in the Andes of Peru, again, this time in the southern Andes, where they were Quechua-speaking, and I did learn quite a lot of Quechua. That's the language of the Inca Empire. Came back to the United States in 64 to Madison, Wisconsin, and that's where I have stayed the rest of my life. And as far as the gay part of my life, up until that time when I came back to the United States, I knew since I was 7 that something was fishy. I didn't know exactly what it was, but there really wasn't a whole lot in the 40s and the 50s to tell you what it was. There was that pianist from Milwaukee, what's his name?
Liberace.
Well, you know, you saw Liberace or heard him, and you didn't want anything to do with that. I mean, I didn't. I didn't identify with him, shall we say. I had some experiences with men. They were purely sexual experiences. It wasn't like we made friends or anything. And through the 60s, it was, through most of the 60s, it was largely like that. What happened during the 60s, really, from 64 until 70, was very, very active in the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. I was I also finally came out as a gay man, but it was a confusing time because in the 60s, for example, when you went to the student union and you talked with another gay person, you didn't get together with three people because one of them might be a screamer or might, you know, squeal or let out something, and then, you know, they'd be on you, the straight people. And it was a very odd time. When we had parties, finally, when I had come out during the late 60s, and you go to a party at a gay man's house, you always had plenty of lesbians or straight women who liked gay men there, because when the police came, and they almost always did, it seems to me those parties got raided quite often. And I don't know why. I mean, maybe we made a lot of noise and the neighbors just called. But as soon as the sirens started and the police came, we all partnered up, you know, with a lesbian and pretended it was a straight party, because at that time, it would have been terrible to be arrested as a gay man. And of course, we lived here in Madison, where I don't remember exactly when the first gay bar started, but mostly in those days, you just met people like in the bus depot, in the, you know, bathroom and places like that. There was a bar, the Velvet Swing, which after 11 o'clock became gay. It was straight before then. The only awkward part of it was that occasionally straight people would wander in when it was gay, which would be from 11 to 1 or whenever it was open. And you lived in terror of, you know, somebody you knew seeing you there when it was all men. And that did happen. I had people come in occasionally who knew me, and it was sort of awkward. What can I say? The other thing that happened during the 60s was my alcoholism, which had kind of begun in, I would say, by 1959, 1960, I'd had a few drunks that were really rather serious. But by the late 60s, I was drinking a lot and having a lot of problems. I actually went to, I don't know, I think five or six of the graduate schools at the University of Wisconsin, because I would either drop out and not be able to finish the course. I had started working at a library, Memorial Library, in the mid-60s. I had been picked up by then a man who was the head of the catalog department there. And at that time, the bar that is nearest to the university...
602?
The 602 was very strange. The 602 was divided into three parts. Sort of the intellectuals, the students, and the gay part. But there was the other bar, the college club, which actually was almost in Memorial Library during the 60s. It was almost part of it. It was so close. It wasn't across the street. It was next to the building. I'd gotten very drunk, fell off a stool, and this man picked me up, took me home, well, the usual happened, and he gave me a job in the catalog department at the University of Wisconsin. And it was very interesting how that happened, because the man who interviewed me for the job was not him, but it was a man whose cousin had been my head professor of English at Augustana College, who was a marvelous person. And when we got to talking about that, he realized I must be a wonderful person, so I was hired. Later on, the man tried to get me fired because he didn't like me, but it didn't work. So I worked at Memorial, and I started going to library school, and I finally did get a master's. I was hired in 1970 by the Wisconsin Department of Justice to become their first law librarian, and I, in fact, made a career out of that and was the law librarian for the Wisconsin Department of Justice from the fall of 1970 until 2000, when I retired. and I had a marvelous career. By the 70s, it was interesting. Gay people started, you know, Stonewall happened in 1969, and I didn't even know about it. But I was out by 1970. And by the way, 1970 is when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous and managed to get sober. And I still belong to AA, and I'm still sober. And I just celebrated 42 years of being sober in March, which is amazing. It was those people gave me a whole new life. And there weren't any gay people, or there were very few in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time in Madison, Wisconsin. I remember there was a funeral director. Is that a cliche? And but there were really any other gay people, and all the meetings were basically straight people, but it didn't matter. In AA, the thing is, if you're an alcoholic, if you have a problem with alcohol, that's what we're there for, and that's what we work on. We don't care anything else about the rest of it. Thank goodness. So I sobered up in 70, and I got this job with the Justice Department as the law librarian. And I published a couple of books within the first 10 years, which made my name nationally as a law librarian. They're pretty irrelevant now. They were index digests of the opinions of the Attorney General. They were very significant then because they cut research from 4 hours down to like 5 minutes. But now it's all on computer, so they're unimportant. But I still have a card in the main catalog of the Library of Congress, and my name will be there as long as it's there. And so that was quite wonderful. I met someone in 71, I think it was, and we were together for almost 10 years, and then we broke up. There were interesting things that happened in the gay movement then. I remember belonging to the Gay Liberation Front, GLF, and we had meetings at the co-op on Langdon Street. And I remember there were huge disagreements between basically the lesbians, the gay women, and the gay men. The lesbians were at that time being caught up in the feminist movement. And everything that was wrong with the world and with life was the fault of men. And they needed their space, blah, blah, blah. And I remember one meeting where this lesbian came in. We didn't have very many women in the movement in the early days, the Gay Liberation Front and the gay organizations. A woman came in and she started a rant about how men were responsible for everything. And I got up and I got mad myself. And most of the gay men there, they were, I don't know what's the matter, they were cowed, basically. They were afraid of, you know, women, I think, or they couldn't deal with them. Well, I could. And I got up and told her that the only trouble was them, that they didn't come and that they didn't participate, and when they came it was so unpleasant that who wanted to deal with it. And she was so mad. I don't remember what happened at that meeting. I'm sure she must have left because it didn't go down the way she thought it was going to. And so gay liberation was going on, and there were many events, and we were all feeling finally, you know, that we had a place in the world and that we weren't so afraid of being exposed as gay men and women. And also, Wisconsin was interesting. It became the first state, actually, to protect gay men in their workplace and so on. That has sort of changed in some ways, but anyway. It was an exciting time. I remember going to Washington, D.C. to the first gay and lesbian civil rights march. And that was in, the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. And it was October 14th. That I remember. I can't seem to remember the year.
79, Michael?
Well, yeah, was it October 14th of 79?
I think so.
Anyway, and this booklet that I have here tells all of the events that happened. And it was the most thrilling time, I can tell you. I had no vacation time left, so I took sick leave to take one of the 7 buses that loaded up from Madison, Wisconsin, and went to Washington for this march. And I remember when I came back to be absolutely horrified when one of the lost clerks of ours who were law students dumped a student newspaper on my desk. What was it?
The Cardinal.
And on the front page was a picture of me and a whole bunch of others marching. And I was very, there was no doubt, it was very clear who it was. It was me and the front row. And we were all very, and I thought, oh boy, this is really going to be terrible, because the Division of Criminal Investigation was on the floor above me, above the library in the Lorraine building, which is where we were housed. And I knew they got copies of the Cardinal just routinely, and I thought, oh, someone's going to find out. Well, nothing happened, actually, nothing at all. And besides, they wouldn't have probably done anything to me, except that I had taken sick leave instead of vacation time.
What was special about being at that march?
What was so special about being at that march is I had never in my life seen so many gays and lesbians in one place. I had been to marches against the war in Vietnam, but this was our march, and this was our feeling that we were finally part of the United States and part of the political establishment, part of... it was the most enthralling feeling. I mean, and we had, you know, bands that played, and there were theater, there were plays that were put on. It was just the feeling of you weren't alone. And I do remember so clearly during the 60s especially, but even during the 70s, very often thinking I'm the only one in the world. That's ridiculous. But that's how you felt, and that's how many gays and lesbians felt, that they were the only ones. I mean, there was nothing on television. There was nothing like Modern Family. I don't know if you've seen that. It's a hilarious program. We watch it religiously. And as I say, back then it was Liberace or nothing, and most of us were not Liberace. We weren't that talented. Furthermore, we wouldn't dress up like that, and we didn't have our mothers on stage. And, you know, all that bullshit about, well, homosexuals, you're homosexual because you have a strong mother and a weak father. That's ridiculous. If anything, it was the opposite in my family. And besides, my sister became a lesbian, and I became a gay man, and my two brothers are straight as can be. So you figure that out. I mean, who was responsible? Who did it? Who knows?
Was that a question that came up often?
Well, yes, especially during, the Psychiatry Association, whatever the Diplomat of Psychiatry, whatever they're called, published their major work defining homosexuality as a disease, as a, you know, mental disorder. And it wasn't until 73 or 4 that they finally took it out. And it wasn't a disorder, because all they'd ever seen was people who were emotionally disturbed, but not necessarily because they were gay, although if they were gay, you know, those were the only ones they ever saw. They didn't see the rest of us who just led our lives, you know. It was a big deal. And the major theory that most psychiatrists seem to have had to do with the weak father, the absent father, and the strong mother, a strong woman, you know. And I remember that I landed in the mental ward of the University of Wisconsin twice, both for suicide attempts. The reason that I committed suicide, well, there were various, but I was a drunk, and there isn't any particular reason. If you're drinking, you do all sorts of bizarre things to yourself. And I was the kind that would just decide life wasn't worth living. And when I went in there the first time, the mental ward, they were having, of course, group meetings for the people who were in there. And I don't remember that we ever discussed homosexuality or anything like that. But I do remember that my lover at that time, and I did have one, came in and visited me. And when he left the ward, he hugged me. I don't think he kissed me, but anybody hugged me. We didn't used to kiss very much in those days. I mean, gay men didn't do that. They didn't walk down the street holding hands or anything like that. And the head psychiatrist who was running that place, Ward B1, University of Wisconsin, back in... I don't know, 69.
The General Hospital?
Yeah, Madison, University of Wisconsin Hospital. The old hospital, not the new one. He came in and he said, "We're not here to cure homosexual relations and to fix up homosexuality in any way." He didn't say it quite like that, but that's what he talked about. They weren't there to deal with homosexuality. It wasn't something they were going to fix. Not that I had ever asked them to do anything like that. That wasn't what I was there for. I was there because I got very drunk, very depressed, felt totally lonely, and just tried to kill myself. And after I sobered up, which was the next morning, I wasn't being given any drugs to keep me off the ceiling or off the floor because there was nothing. I really didn't have a mental problem that they could deal with. But so they fastened, and they didn't do anything with alcoholism because they didn't know how to do that very well. And it was not considered a kind of illness. They weren't very successful with it, let's say, and they still aren't. One-to-one therapy doesn't generally work terribly well with addiction. That's why group therapy works better, and it doesn't work all that well either. But I remember can you imagine how that made me feel? Basically, I was a pariah, that's what I was, and they weren't going to deal with that part. Not that I'd asked them to. And I was very happy to get out of there, needless to say. They did nothing for my alcoholism, which was really the major problem, which I hadn't focused on yet at that point. And they certainly didn't do anything about my being homosexual, because that was fine. I mean, I was already fine with that, even though I was an alcoholic. So yes, there was a lot involved with the problem of homosexuals and the psychiatric world, the world of psychiatry and the world of treating people for mental problems. It was just considered a mental problem, but they weren't doing much with it. I don't know what else to tell you other than it was an amazing thing to me. First of all, the first experience I had of really feeling the normalcy of being gay and being who I was when I went out to San Francisco. I started going to these professional meetings, the American Association of Law Librarians meetings, and they were held in different cities. And the first one I went to was in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I met several librarians from San Francisco who were gay. I mean, and they weren't all gay, but most of them were gay. And one of them became a friend, and so about 2 years later, I went and stayed with him in San Francisco for a week. Our meeting happened to be in Los Angeles then, this law librarian meeting, and from then I flew up to San Francisco and I stayed with him for a week. I simply couldn't believe what I saw there. I was in the Castro, of course, which was a gay ghetto, and I'd never been in a gay ghetto. And at that time, the postman was gay, the policemen were gay, the stores were, but they were normal, you know what I mean? There wasn't anything strange about it, other than the fact that they were all gay. I just, and men were walking down the street holding hands, they were kissing, they were doing all, it was incredible. I came back from there, I dropped about 5 masks that I'd been wearing that I didn't even know I'd been wearing here in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, as I say, we didn't walk down the street holding hands, and we didn't, you know. And the funniest part was that I sponsor people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That means that you, the things that you don't bring up at meetings, then you usually pick out a man or a woman or men and women who you admire or you respect how they are, and you deal with your problems on a one-to-one basis, things that you wouldn't want to bring up in a general meeting. And those of us who do that, who are good at it, and not everybody is, are called sponsors. And I, at that time, was very good at being a sponsor already, and this was like 74, 75, 76. And when I came back here, I had 2 guys that I was sponsoring, and they were both about 6'6". One was an ex-Wisconsin football player, basketball player, and the other one was a Dane County, you know, he was a sheriff, not a sheriff, but one of those people give you tickets on the highway and so on. A patrolman, he was a patrolman. And they were in their early 30s, and they were sobering up in AA, and I happened to be their sponsor. And it was just ridiculous. We would go down to the Union and sit on the terrace, and I would work with them. And I every other paragraph I would say, don't pick up a drink today. That's, you know, how you start out. That's the major thing you have to learn. Don't drink no matter what. And then I'd say, and by golly, you know, I can't believe it. You look around here, you can't tell any gay people if you look around here. You know, there's nobody here. I said, I just came back from San Francisco, and you wouldn't believe the freedom we have out there. I just would go to our brand. And they were, neither one of them was gay, and they're not gay now. I still know. They're still friends. And they were just like, you know, uh-huh. And then I'd say, and don't drink today, you know, don't drink today. And it was just like, my whole life changed after that visit to San Francisco. I came out big time, much bigger than I had before. I had less patience with people who had a problem with it. You know, and they didn't have a problem with it. They were just trying to get sober. And I didn't have a problem with them being straight either. And they weren't a problem to me. They obviously, you know, trusted me. But, oh, God. I remember it was hilarious. My behavior just kind of went to pieces there a little bit. You know, didn't hurt them. Didn't hurt me. But the freedom of being in a society where you were okay, no matter, you know, that you were gay. What else can I say?
How did that, you mentioned prior to that feeling a sense of loneliness?
Oh, yes, an incredible sense of loneliness. As I say, since I was 7, I knew something was fishy. Something was not quite right with me. I mean, I was different. And part of that manifested itself is that I was a sissy, and, you know, though I wasn't anybody to be messed with because I had a really smart tongue and I was really intelligent and I knew how to get even with you if you messed with me. But even so, it was very difficult. And I was very attracted to men from day one, and yet I knew that was wrong. It was sinful, supposedly, although my parents weren't particularly religious in that sense. They didn't bring me up to think that. There just was no information. Mm. And so there I was during the 60s and the early 70s especially, trying to navigate through my life, beginning to try. First of all, I didn't think that I could have a relationship with another man. I mean, a relationship, like a marriage. And I was brought up in a very happy family, quite frankly. I can only blame my alcoholism on myself. It was not in my family. And being gay was another thing. And so I felt very alienated all the time. And I didn't know that you could have a relationship with another man. I knew you could have sex with him. I was having lots of sex by the time I was, well, not lots. It was more difficult when there weren't any gay bars and there weren't any places that you knew except bus depots and bathrooms and bushes. And I mean, it wasn't that much fun being gay. And, you know, trying to recognize another gay person who's closeted and making those moves, wondering whether you would get beaten up if you made a mistake, or killed, or whatever. You weren't always sure what would happen when you started to maybe, you know, put the moves on somebody, because even though you thought they were gay, outside of the screaming queens, which there weren't that many of them running around screaming either in the early days, it was just really difficult, and you felt very alone. And I fell in love with a couple of men in the late 60s. And remember, I was drinking alcoholically by then, but I fell in love. And I finally realized that, I guess, you know, I realized, well, maybe I could know this person more than just for sex. Maybe we could be friends. I didn't think you could have, like, the concept of moving in, the concept of having a lover who you were with all the time didn't exist in my mind. It just didn't exist. And but finally it did, and I began to realize that it was just like a straight man that I was helping get sober in AA, that was a sponsor. He used to come to my house here when I had bought it in the late 70s, and I still had this lover that lasted all through the 70s. And we were having this conversation, and he was going out with a girlfriend and everything, and finally he said, "You really love," and my lover's name was Reese. He said, "You really love him. I mean, you, like, really love him, right?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I mean, like, I love," whoever the woman was at that point. He said, "Like, you know, I love Janice, and we go out together, and you really care about him like that, right?" I mean, it was stunning to him to realize that we were like husband and wife, only husband and husband, I suppose, whatever. And that was me earlier in my life. Now, of course, I've been with the same man for 28 years, and we celebrate things in our 35th year. We went on the Queen Mary 2, and we went to England, and it was like being in the movies. And we sat at a table, you're seated with other people, and you dress up every night and everything. It's really quite elegant and quite marvelous. And we were with two straight couples. There's a couple from New Zealand, this retired businessman and his wife, and this Scottish professor and his wife, and then Dwayne and I. And, you know, we were asked why we were on this trip, and we said, "Well, we're celebrating, you know, 35 years of being together." Oh, they thought that was so interesting. The New Zealand couple, the man was just fascinated. He didn't think he'd ever met a homosexual, didn't know what they were. He asked me so many questions. It was hilarious. He said, well, can you tell another one when you see him? You know? And I said, well, I said, it's kind of difficult. You can't always tell, you know. Then I pointed to Dwayne, who's my partner, and I said, well, look at him. He said, yeah, well, he's a guy. And I said, yeah, and how about me? And he said, well, you're a little different. And I said, this is like a 75-year-old guy with his wife. And she's trying to shut him up all the time. It never worked. It was hilarious, though. He was fascinated. He asked all sorts of funny questions, but they were the questions that, you know, would have been my questions 30 years before or something, you know. How can you tell one when you see one? Well, the problem is that you can't always. Sometimes you can. Oh, quite often. I mean, you know, we have gaydar and it works pretty well a lot of the time. Like 60% of the time, they just had a study in the New York Times that they actually had a study. And they realized, they said that there really was such a thing. And it was about 60% accurate, which isn't great, but there's something there. But
what year was that? The Queen Mary?
Oh, the Queen Mary? Well, that was 3 years ago. It was, whatever.
Oh, nine?
Here. I have a memory like a sieve, you know, I'm 73. Never remember anything. Yeah. Here it is, a transatlantic crossing, May 10th of 2008. So, we've been together 35 years.
So this is your 39th year?
Yeah. Is it? Right? No, that was 25 years.
25,
sorry.
That's what I thought. 25,
25
yeah.
years.
That's what I thought. 25
yeah.
years.
But it can feel. Like
it'll be 30 years.
Next year?
Yes.
Michael.
Yes, that's something. Well, and the other thing that happened, you know, gay life has changed so much. During my life, I always wanted to have children, to have a family. I mean, because I came from a very happy family. And I puzzled around in my mind many times, well, I could have an arrangement with a straight woman. Maybe I could have a marriage of convenience. And all those things have happened, you know. Never crossed my mind until finally what happened during the 80s when AIDS was in its really terrible time when nobody was getting well, and I was working in the Madison AIDS Support Network. In fact, I was one of the 8 men that founded it. It's not even called that anymore. It's called the AIDS Network, I don't think. And it's kind of a government organization now. But back then, there was nobody, and there was Will Handy and Chaz Pope and myself and 5 other people formed this Madison AIDS Network to work with people with AIDS because nobody else would and was doing anything. We were all terrified. But anyway, several years into that, I answered an ad in the Isthmus. That's how I got involved in the AIDS Network. Will Handy and Chaz Pope put an ad in the Isthmus because they were desperate. There was just the two of them. And that's how I got started doing that. And then I saw this ad from these two lesbians who were wanted to have a child, and they wanted a gay man to father it. And so I answered it, and it was the oddest experience. You know, Madison is a very small town. You really know everybody, or you know of them. And while I didn't know these two women specifically, I knew one of the closest friends of one of the women, and I knew some of the other people that they knew, so we all knew each other. But we kind of dated. I mean, we went out, the three of us, and got to know each other. And they finally picked me amongst a field of, I don't know, 4 or 5 men that they decided to father their child. So it was actually this one lesbian who was more interested than the other one. But anyway, so we had a child together. Yeah, so how did you do it? Well, it was the artificial insemination. It wasn't, you know, the lesbian wasn't into, I was very into it because I like women and they're great. You know, it's fun, but it's not quite it, but it works. But she wasn't having anything to do with that, so we did it artificially, and that was fine. We had a child, and my daughter is now 24 years old. She graduated last year from Earlham College, and she went to Israel for 6 months and worked, and now she's going to go in the fall to graduate school in linguistics, and she's fine. You know, she's an interesting person and a nice person. But she was over here, she was a bottle baby, so she was over here from her eighth day on, once a week and sometimes twice a week, and sometimes if the lesbians went on a two-week vacation, Alana was over here. So it was a hands-on thing, and my lover, thank goodness, didn't depart. When I told him that I was thinking of doing this, he said, oh, okay. He didn't realize how different it would be. You have a child, you know, you're ruined. You have to go to their preschool, you have to be on the board of their preschool, you have to go to their little performances, which are dreadful, you know, for the first 10, 15 years. I hate children anyway. You have to watch them knock their fucking blocks down 10 times. You know, look at me, Daddy, look at me. And you go, oh, there's nothing to look at. I want to read my novel. But anyway, it was a fabulous thing. And it brought, I have a family in my life. And we, even though Alana is not physically here right now, the two lesbians and my partner and I, we have dinner together, we celebrate stuff together. And all through the years, we celebrated stuff. You know, her bat mitzvah was this huge event. My family all came, my brother and sister-in-law and my nieces and their husbands and their boyfriends and everybody. And they're not Jewish, and I'm not Jewish either for that matter, but Alana's mother is Jewish, so she's Jewish. And she went to temple and she had a bat mitzvah. It's a huge event. And I remember telling my family, I said, it's like a wedding. I said, it's that kind of a celebration. It's a very formal thing, and by golly, you're going to give a gift, give something really nice. This isn't like an anniversary or a birthday party or a first communion. This is, you know, several steps up from that. And so we had her bat mitzvah. There were 100 people, and it was just the most fabulous event. I loved it. I like ceremonies anyway. And so it was a very enriching part of my life to realize I had my dream. I had a family. It wasn't quite in the form that I had in thought about it, but even better, it worked out just fine. But you don't know those things when you're starting. Well, now you do. My God, I mean, there's so much information about us. We're no longer even special. Look where I live. I live in between two straight people, and I have a house and pay a mortgage. Well, I don't have a mortgage anymore, thank goodness. Oh. But, you know, I cut the lawn and everything, you know, and their little kids run across my lawn, and my little kid ran across the lawn when she was little. And, you know, it's a mix here, you know. One house over, there's the head of gay theater. Tara? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then one over is straight people, and one over there is two gay men, and, you know.
But what was it like in the 70s when you moved in? Did it feel the same way?
79, yeah. When I moved in.
What was it?
How I bought the house in 78 or 79, and I moved in, and it was Earl and Diane lived next door. They didn't have children. He was a government worker, federal government worker. She was a school teacher. And next door, I forget exactly who was living there, because my favorite ones who moved in within a few years after I moved in was a policeman and his wife. In fact, Udacy and his wife, they moved in. And that was really interesting. But anyway, Earl and Diane lived next door, and I wasn't, I decided to buy a house, but I decided to buy a house, and at that time I was partnered with somebody who I'm not partnered with then. It had to be within 10 blocks of work. It had to be on bus lines. There were all sorts of considerations, but I didn't even think about whether it was gay or straight neighborhood. In fact, I told you what happened when I went to a gay ghetto for the first time. I mean, I was transformed, but I wouldn't want to live in a gay ghetto. Ick, you know.
How so?
Well, you can get too much of anything, and you can get too much of gay, you know, ick. I mean, it's just too much. And it's like being in a room full of English majors. I mean, it's fascinating. You study, you know, literature, and you're interested in literature, but you're interested in a lot of other things besides that. And so a few hours of being in a room full of English majors, you want to be in a room full of normal people, regular people. And a gay neighborhood, no, I wouldn't really want to be in a gay neighborhood. I'm kind of thinking a gay old folks home might be pretty kicking, you know, might be fun in a different way. You can get too many straight people, too, and there comes the postman. And it is a postman, and so on. But I remember the house up the next one that Tara lives in, at that time, had a straight couple in it, and Earl and Diane were straight. It was me, and very soon after I moved in, of course, Earl and Diane knew what they had next to them. And they were great neighbors, and I was a great neighbor, and then these neighbors, they got divorced, and a gay man bought the house. And I remember Earl came over here, and he said, "Michael, I have to ask you something." He said, "Is this neighborhood targeted?" I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you know who moved in? I don't remember his name." I said, "Yeah. Well, you know, is it targeted?" And I caught on right away. Oh, he thought, you know, it was targeted for gay people, that we were going to start moving in big time and buy all the houses. I said, "Yes, Earl." Hey. He just looked at me. It was not the right answer. He realized I was making fun of him, which I was. But they were great neighbors. No, I never thought a thing about when I bought a house. I wasn't interested in it being in a gay neighborhood particularly. I mean, I was interested in it being, I'm glad it's a very liberal neighborhood if you look at the signs. Most of us are either Democrats or even farther to the left of that. We're all, you know, I would like accepting people, and they aren't all entirely. There are one or two houses that, you know. But
with Earl and Dan, Dan is short for Danielle, or Dan, Earl and Dan, Dan is
no,
Danielle,
it's, no, it's Earl and Diane,
Diane,
yeah,
Diane,
straight
sorry.
People, yeah, Earl and Diane, you know. And. I know, Diane was horrified when I had Alana, you know, and she started showing up every week at my house because she's a school teacher and she didn't want anything to do with children after hours. And I said, "That's all right, Diane, you won't have to take care of her or anything." She said, "Why would you want kids?" I said, "Well, you know, I ask myself that sometimes." Because I was 49 when Alana was born. I decided I was too old. But now, she's 24, I'm 73, it doesn't seem to make any difference. But
you're a youthful 73.
No, yeah, right.
Will you say more about the beginning of Madison AIDS Network and sort of what were the concerns you were trying to do? What was the situation? What were we?
Well, the Madison AIDS Network, it began because back when the first couple patients came in with AIDS and were in the hospital, and they usually were in hospital then. They were people who moved back from San Francisco or wherever they'd been. They came come home to die, basically. Mm-hmm. But I remember one person, one friend of mine, Neil Peckett, in fact. Do you know Donna and Danielle? Yeah, Neil is Donna's brother. And Neil was a very close friend of mine. And in fact, he was also somebody I sponsored who sobered up. And we were very close friends. And he came down with AIDS, or the first kind of AIDS. I don't know what the illness was he had, but he was in Methodist Hospital. It's not Methodist anymore. It doesn't exist. But and I remember we'd visit him. I'd visit him in the hospital, and you had to gown up. You had to wear glasses, goggles, mask, gloves, completely covered. They had no idea how it was transmitted at that time. But they knew that he had that illness that gay men had. They knew already that it seemed to be connected with gay men, a lot of it. And I remember the first time I visited him like that, you know, and I mean, he didn't even know who you were until you, you know, managed to talk to him or something. Well, it was like that then, and nobody was really... Other things that happened, and I didn't see this happen, and I didn't see it happen in university hospitals, but I know that it did happen. You know, they would leave their food outside the door. They wouldn't even take the tray in the room because they were so terrified of getting this thing. And we were all terrified. And so the reason Will and Chaz Pope, Chaz at that time was kind of a nurse. He was a practical nurse. I think he was a practical. PRN, yeah. These men would come into the hospital, and I forget what hospital he worked in. It wasn't Methodist. I think he worked at
the university.
Yeah, he worked at university hospitals. Realized that somebody had to start educating and taking care of these men, no matter what they had and what was wrong with them. They were gay men. And Chaz was gay. Will Handy was gay. He was a psychotherapist. He lives in Texas now. And so they formed this group. There were eight of us at first. And we were all gay men. No, there's one gay woman. And, yeah, seven gay men. And we started taking care of people with AIDS. Like when they would leave the hospital or they would be in their home, we would start, you know, doing everything from giving them meals to whatever needed to be done that nobody else would do. And often these people were rejected completely by their families. I remember one man, Paul, that I took care of in the early days. I became actually his legal guardian because nobody would deal with him. I mean, he was, you know, and nobody would help him make decisions. His lover was not capable of doing that kind of thing and just kind of basically moved to Chicago. He was too scared, you know, by the whole thing. So I became his legal guardian, and I had to make the decisions of, you know, when we would... I remember I had to decide several times to put him in psychiatric ward. Can you imagine what that made me feel? But that was what had to be done because he would be crazy. He had AIDS dementia. Mm-hmm. And he's a beautiful person, but he never really was all very... tight together, you know. He was sort of a loose bundle to begin with. But he's very bright and very nice and very interesting and, you know, talented. But, oh, Paul, I remember when I first visited him, he had this Cupid doll thing with a southern dress on the wall pinned up, and this was in university hospitals. Things had gotten a little more liberal then. You know, I wasn't gowned from head to toe. And on the other wall, he had this butch guy, you know. And the first thing he said to me was, "We don't have to talk about AIDS, do we?" I just looked at him and thought, well, no. But, you know, we took care of them, and there were eight of us. It was very hard. We met every week in somebody's living room and talked over our problems and our feelings. and what we felt. And I had made a deal with God that if I didn't get AIDS and that nobody really close to me got AIDS, I would do this. I would join this network and become part of this network. Well, of course, that didn't work out.
What year was the visit to your friend?
Oh, God. Was it 83 or 84?
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. And I worked there for 10 years. And that was when everybody who got AIDS died. Okay. They did. They just died. And they died horribly. They died horribly. It was just more than you could bear. And we were all terrified. I remember I had spray bottles of what was it that was supposed to kill the AIDS bug at that time?
Oh, you're right.
Chlorine. Anyway, I had spray bottles of it everywhere in the house. I was just as terrified as anybody else, but I also was not going to give in to it. I had had as much training as a practical nurse, and besides, these were my people. And so I just waded right in, and of course, later on, it turned out it's really very difficult to get it. Really difficult. By the way, it's not over, and people are getting it all the time. But it is very difficult to get it. And you can't get it usually by giving a blowjob. You can't get it by swallowing gum. You can't get it by all sorts of intimate things. But you sure as hell get it if you get it in the ass. You can get it. Or if you are stuck with a needle that's had somebody's blood on it. I mean, it's still, and you still die of it sooner or later. After my daughter was born, Dwayne decided to get tested. I remember, I thought that would be great, because I was tested a billion times, and I was so surprised that I didn't have it. I mean, I was shocked. I went back and got tested again because I thought it must be a false negative. But for some reason, I haven't gotten it. And for some reason, I must be immune. I don't mean... Really, absolutely. I mean, if anybody... Boy, all the things I've done everywhere in San Francisco, and oh my God, I was...
Were you using condoms?
Oh, are you kidding? Using condoms? We didn't know about condoms when it was the high time when you were getting it. You know, afterwards, after we found out about the condoms prevented it, but that was far too late. I mean, I had been going to the baths, and you know, you get fucked by five men in the night. I mean, you people just date. You don't even do anything on the first time. You go out with people, you date them. I don't understand the concept. What you do is you go out, you get laid, and then you find out whether you have anything in common, whether you become friends or even, you know, occasional lovers. That's how it worked then. There wasn't any of this dating, and you know, you went to bed with people. You went to the bar, you picked somebody up, you went to bed. And you went to the baths, and you got fucked by five people if you were, you know, like that. Or you fucked them five people. Anyway, I remember in San Francisco, when I was out there, they had done this study. Somebody had done a study, and they said that there are some homosexuals that have been together with 500 men. My God, they couldn't believe it, you know, the people who did this study. And there were those of us who bought these T-shirts that said, have you had your first 500 yet? Because we knew perfectly well we had 5,000. And I don't mean you'd come 5,000 times, but you had sexual contact. You'd go to the tubs, you know, on a two-week vacation. You go to the tubs every other night and you'd have sex with, I don't know, say 10 people each time, and 10 times 7 is what, 70. Doesn't take long to get to 500, you know, and over decades. My goodness. Well, anyway, I didn't get AIDS. And it turned out Dwayne was tested and he had it. I was just absolutely appalled. And this was in the first year of our relationship. Because when did we meet? You have to do the math. If it's been 25, 26, 27 years, it's whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we knew, we even knew who he'd gotten it from. One of two people. Somebody from New York and somebody here who died. Well, that art librarian, forget his name, many, many years ago. was before your time, Scott. But and it's irrelevant who you get it from. It's a disease. It's a, you know. And so Duane has been living with AIDS for 28 years, you know. And it's marvelous because these drugs finally came along that worked. Now, it's not a cure. It's a chronic illness. And believe me, you don't want a chronic illness. You'd rather be dead. It's really horrible. Taking care of a chronic illness is almost worse than just dying. I know, because I'm old. I'm 73. I have several chronic things, you know. Diabetes, and you know, I take little boxes full of pills every day. It's very annoying, but anyway, they lived. But at the time that I got involved with Mass and AIDS Network, they were all dying all the time. I went to 5 funerals 1 week, and 3 of them were friends, and 2 of them were just people that I'd worked with. But it was appalling. I thought, this is like this is worse than a war. I mean, I don't. It's a wonder that any of us came out sane. Quite frankly, we weren't entirely sane all the time. I have to tell you that it got very crazy. Very crazy. And so we met together every week, those of us who were doing this work. Because you got so involved in these people's lives. And I remember, in fact, when Paul died, who I was his legal guardian, so I had, in fact, made the decision several days before that they were to stop medications. Which was his death sentence. And the day he died, they called me up at work, and I was going anyway to a funeral that afternoon of a friend of mine who died of AIDS, a librarian, in fact, the art librarian that I was telling you about, who went blind in his last illness and a few other things, and people wouldn't go near him and wouldn't touch him and stuff. It was so sad. It was still kind of early days. And so I was going to, and so I went to the hospital, and Paul was dying. But I told the nurse, I said, okay, you know, don't do any, if he dies while I'm gone, I went to the funeral. I said, don't do anything. Don't move him. Don't call his family. Don't do, his family, by the way, were nice Roman Catholics from southeast Wisconsin. Never came to see him once. But they snatched the body right away, and they had a Catholic mass over him. It was just disgusting. His fundamentalist sister, who was married to an army man, and they were both military people, in fact. His sister kept up with him every week by telephone and kept up with me because I was his primary guardian, and sent pictures of her wedding. And she came with her husband to his alternative funeral that we had here. When he died, he had been living actually in Dane County home for, I don't know, it's not called that anymore. It's out near Stoughton or somewhere out there, and they keep people who are crazy, chronically ill. But they'd moved him in this final illness. They moved him into Madison University Hospitals, and that's where I made this decision. Well, anyway, while I was at the funeral, he died. And I remember going back there, and the nurse said, well, I haven't touched anything. I haven't told anybody, so you just go in and talk to him. Do whatever you do, you know, want to do. And she was very nice. And I remember talking to him and just realizing how terrible this was, that, you know, his family would never come and visit him, never see him, except his sister. That sister, well, she didn't come until his funeral. That went on for 10 years, and it was very rough because, as they say, I had made a deal, I thought, with God, whoever that is, that I would do this work if, you know, nobody I knew or nobody was close to me, or including me, would get it. Well, I didn't get it, so maybe that part of the deal worked out. But the rest of it didn't. And that was a terrible thing for the AIDS, for the gay, you know, community, because we became branded for several years, seriously branded. People would not, you know, you would take donuts to work to celebrate your birthday and nobody would eat one because, you know, you probably had AIDS and they would get it and they would die. It's just like you became a pariah all over again. You became other. You became alien. You became the enemy. Or someone to be pitied and feel sorry for. Someone to be careful around, you know. And that was very upsetting, since we had gotten all this freedom you know, started feeling completely safe and happy. And it was branded the gay, you know, gay illness in the early days, because so many gay men got it. And they didn't know about Africa then. They didn't know about some of the other countries where it's more prevalent among straight people, basically.
What were women around you doing at the time, particularly?
Well, the lesbians were really amazing. Many of the lesbians, many of them joined the network when they found out about it or when they decided to. And they were very supportive of gay men. And it drew actually gay men and lesbians together a lot. They became much closer and they worked with one another in different causes and worked with one another. They were very supportive. Women generally are good at that, and lesbians are women, you know, let's face it. I'm sorry I'm being nasty, but they are women. And so, you know, and besides, we were, even though they didn't like men, even some of them then, still, we were, you know, their brothers, their gay brothers. And and many of them had close gay male friends. And so it touched their community too. And even though not many of them got AIDS, despite all the hoo-ha about it, you know, it being a woman's illness, lesbians didn't get it because they didn't sleep with men who had it. So lesbians were the safest thing to be at that time, you know. I remember when, who was that actor who died?
Rock Hudson.
Yes, for Christ's sake. Rock Hudson died, you know, and that was the first time Reagan ever mentioned the word, I think. And anyway, this one straight lawyer at work, this woman, called me into her office and she said, "Oh, Rock Hudson died and he was one of my all heroes, and oh, he died of AIDS, and oh, what am I going to do, and what, you know, what can I do?" And she was, of course, terrified because she was single and she was dating, you know, and probably going to bed with some of them. I'm sure she was going to bed with them. She wasn't doing it big time like we did, the gay men, but she was, you know, she was having sex with men. And, you know, she was horrified when she suddenly realized this idol of hers, who supposedly was straight, wasn't in fact. So how could you then tell? And I remember I was just disgusted with the whole thing at that time. I was not sympathetic, shall we say, to straight people at all about AIDS and about gay things at all. I was very aggressive by that time. I didn't allow people to mess with me or make jokes or talk about it. And she's just looking at me, walking, and I said, "You know what, honey, just become a lesbian. They're not getting it." She just looked at me. I said, "It's not difficult." Said a lot of women do it. She never broached the subject again. She realized she was this is the wrong person to talk to. I was just mad. I was just furious. You know.
So you and Michael meet in 84. And then within that...
Me and Dwayne.
I mean, I'm sorry, you and Dwayne.
Yeah.
And then within that first year...
Dwayne, well, Alana was born in... Well, let's see. 87?
Yeah.
Yeah. And by that time, he'd already been infected, but we didn't know that.
Yeah.
He didn't manifest anything, and we weren't doing safe sex either. Yeah. I don't know that we even knew then... That that's how you got it, not in 84. Yeah. I think it, that came out finally in 86, how you actually got it. Mm-hmm. That it was bloodborne, and that's how you got it.
Where did you hear about it?
Oh, well, here. I mean, we got all the news. We read everything there was on AIDS. I mean, there were publications coming out, both gay and straight, on this illness. It was a fascinating new thing. And they discovered, you know, that it was a virus. They discovered it in France, and they discovered it here at the same time. And then they knew it was a bloodborne illness, and then they figured out that, of course, you know, you got it that way.
So you're reading it in newspapers? Or?
Well, you had people calling you on the telephone from cities who were more in touch with what was going on in the research area. But we were getting medical, you know, we would read medical texts or journals. As soon as doctors here became aware of it, you know, and they told patients and so on. And since we were the Madison AIDS Network, we were getting training from San Francisco. We had several people from San Francisco come and give us training, and those people became aware very soon how it was transmitted.
Is that Shanti?
Or? Yeah, Shanti. We had Shanti training is what we had, actually. And I don't know exactly how I found out about it. We had these meetings every week, and so Will Handy was certainly getting a lot of the literature, and then he would pass it on to us, pass on the information. And when we found out how you get it, of course, I knew I had it by that time. Several of us, you know, we didn't talk about it, but we just knew, you know, God. And actually, it turned out that several of the gay men that were, oh, do you remember Lee Lewis? You probably never met him.
I don't know.
Oh, what a queen. He was great. He was really nice. But he wasn't one of the people who would have gotten it. You know, there's several of those people were not, they weren't sex pigs. A lot of us were sex pigs. But a lot of us weren't. But those of us who were, you know, like Chaz Pope and me, and so we knew. Well, Chaz did have it. And Chaz died not too long ago. He lived with it for a very, very long time. And he had terrible things. He had a brain problem. He had a lot of different things. Dwayne has never had hardly any of the opportunistic illnesses. He had one small bout with pneumocystis. And pneumocystis was a terrible thing, that pneumonia, because most people who had it, and well, in the early days, they died of it. They almost always died of it. But later on, they didn't so much. And even with medication, though, at least 30% of them die of it still. I mean, it's a very fatal form of pneumonia. But he only had it briefly. You know, they fixed it right away. So, and he's been taking these medications now for many, many, many years.
Did he go on to AZT when it was?
Well, released? The early days, yeah, but he's not on it now. He's on some of the other, I don't know what you call them, the viral, antiviral things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got a marvelous doctor. Dr. Volgum, and his just Bennett has been so marvelous. Bennett was the doctor for many of the people that I worked with. God, I spent all my time in university hospitals. It was quite horrible. Mm-hmm. And because you often had, I wasn't their legal guardians for too many of them, but I was their guardian of their, you know, I was their major health guardian. And that was, you know, the doctor would have to call you, like I had to leave my phone numbers if I went on vacation and so on. If there was some particular procedure that, and we had scenes in the hospital, I'm telling you, it was just horrible.
Like what?
Well, you'd have scenes when your patient had been mistreated in some way, or he felt he had been mistreated, like not dealt with in a good way, because he was gay and because he had AIDS. And then you had to help straighten it out and talk to the nurse involved or the aides involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them, you know, some of the aides and nurses were very religious, you know, and would try to convert that person to Jesus Christ.
They're sick in the hospital?
Yes.
And they're trying to convert
them? Yes. And we caught several of them doing that, which the patient didn't want and they didn't need. And it wasn't, something that they were supposed to be doing anyway. I think it's illegal. But, well, someone like Paul was, you know, he was demented. I mean, he had this AIDS dementia that would creep up on him from time to time, and then finally was almost permanently a feature, which is why he was locked up most of the time during his last 6 months. I remember one time I went to university hospitals, and he was in the mental ward, but he was locked in his room, and he'd been there a long time. And it had been because he'd done something. I don't remember what, some infraction of the rules. He used to frequently take off all his clothes. I mean, he did that sometimes when you took him out. It was very awkward, shall we say, Paul, put your clothes back on. You go to the bar with him, you turn around, he'd be taking his clothes off. I remember one time we went out to pizza, and we were having pizza in this pizzeria, and he wanted to sing a song, and so he did, and, you know, everybody clapped, but it was just like, you never knew exactly what he was. On Golden Pond, you remember that movie? What's her name?
Catherine?
Yeah, Hepburn, and she sang Happy Birthday. That's what he wanted to do, and he did it perfectly. He was a great actor. He sang it just the way she did, you know, in that old woman's voice. But he was... But anyway, he's locked up in this room, and he hadn't been taken care of, really, and I had to go in and say, what did he do, and this isn't appropriate, and you have to, you know, do something different. Well, then they would call the doctor. And then just, it was hard.
In 10 years, Michael, is an awful long time.
Oh.
To do that kind of work. Many people at that time couldn't do it that long. They had to stop.
No,
how?
They couldn't.
How did you do it?
Well, I don't know. I've always had a great capacity for that. Like I said, I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps running a medical post. Can you imagine? And I had to do all sorts of things that were just appalling.
What country was that again?
Peru.
Peru.
Sewing up wounds and things that, you know, you would just not think you would even have the nerve to do. But you had to do them because you were the only one there. I don't know. I had, I've always had a very strong faith, and I'm not quite sure what in. And I don't really have a deity. Well, I do. I have a number of them, but none of them seem to be, you know. I don't really have a rock bottom faith in God, whatever that is. But I'm a very devout Episcopalian, which is like being a Roman Catholic, you know, only without all our worst taste. Our worst sin is bad taste. We don't go in for that other Roman Catholic type guilt stuff.
Yeah.
We don't. So, but we have all the monks and nuns and mass and the whole thing. Since I was a child, I've always been very devoted to and interested in spiritual matters. And I remember as a little boy sitting in a church with the maid, you know, and she was at mass and they were lighting candles, and I knew something magical was there. I've carried that with me all my life. The sacrament of the mass is important to me for some reason. I mean, it's totally demented. You know, we're like cannibals. You eat the body and blood of Christ. What is that? But I do it every Sunday. And I'm mostly a Buddhist. When we get done with all this, I'll show you my altar, and that ought to freak you out. You know, it's got several gods and goddesses on it. It's got Kuan Yin as well as the Virgin Mary. And it's got a Yama with his foot on the devil, just like Mary has her foot on the serpent. And so that comes from Peru and the Pachamama, Mother Earth, faith in the Mother Earth. And I meditate daily.
And when did your interest in Buddhism and meditation start?
Oh, wow. I mean, long ago in California when I was living with my grandmother and my sister, and I was 16, my grandmother and I got involved with these Rosicrucians, and we, you know, you could light candles, and you read these little programs, and you'd meditate. They weren't exactly Buddhists. And then there was the Vedanta temple out there, and I went with a friend of mine to the Vedanta temple several times, and they believe kind of in generally all gods and goddesses, as I understand it. But it's Eastern also. But Buddhism, actual Buddhism, I don't know exactly when Buddhism started, other than the fact that it's been with me a really long time, and I've actually done some Buddhist ceremonies with the Dalai Lama. I took refuge in the Dharma and the Buddha and the Sangha, and I have been to several of his ceremonies that he's had here when he's visited. I'm more a Tibetan Buddhist than any other kind. Every Tuesday night there's a meditation group that meets at the Crossing, which is on University Avenue, and I don't know what variety of... They have a teacher, and I have his two books, and they don't interest me a lot, but I like meditating with them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hello? Too bad, Tom Barrett. Fuck you. Jesus, I don't ever answer phone calls unless they're from friends.
Mr. Barrett was calling you.
Yeah, right.
No, was it one of the surveys?
I don't wait long to find out what it is, because I don't like to talk to people on my telephone, except unless I know them. They can send me things in the mail, but I don't like advertisements, I don't like political things, I don't like, you know, good organizations, nothing. I was hanging up. Sometimes it's awkward because I hang up on my doctor's office calls me or something. And if they don't know my name, you know. Mr. Bem is there? No, nobody's here.
Okay.
Okay.
Your love of gay literature and gay poetry.
Oh, yeah.
Before we move to that, can we?
I just wanted to get...
Sure.
So, just one...
You can ask any questions, really.
One thing I noticed was the move to San Francisco in some way being very transformative or mind-opening.
Oh, yeah, I used to go every year,
okay.
Sometimes twice a year. It became my other home. And there is where I met many Buddhist circles. And see, also, you can go for a whole day in the mission and never speak English. And so there was the Spanish community there, and they were very important to me, aside from the gay community. The gay community was very important to me. My friend Ned died of AIDS. But as actually most of my San Francisco friends did, but I still have many friends out there. Many of them are straight, in fact, and I stay with them now because they're alive. And Dwayne and I have been out to San Francisco a number of times, but I meditated in Buddhist temples there and spent a lot of time in the Mission District, Spanish-speaking people. And it's become a very, very important city to me. In fact, we'll be buried there, or my ashes will be, in the cathedral on Knob Hill, next to some really important people, but all you need is $4,000, and you can get buried there yourself. But I bought that quite a while ago in the Chapel of St. Clair and St. Francis in the cathedral, the Episcopal Cathedral there. And so that's Madison and Buenos Aires and San Francisco are my three homes. I go to Buenos Aires every year too. Forgot to mention that I have 17 cousins in Argentina, and I visit them the last 15 years. And I'm very, very close to them. I have an aunt. I had an uncle, but he's dead now. He died at 92. My aunt is 85. And then their children and their children's children. And when I land at Ezeiza Airport, I become Latino. I mean, I'm no longer, you know, this Midwestern person. Well, I am, but I don't think in English or anything, you know. It's like going home. For me, it's like going home to go to Argentina, even though my mother's buried in Peru and I grew up in Peru. I don't know anybody there anymore. I've been back twice, but I don't know anybody there. And the rest of my family lives in America. My brother's a retired farmer in Illinois. My sister's a lesbian and lives with her lover and works as a legal, what does she do, paralegal or something, in Kansas City, Missouri. And my youngest brother lives out in San Clemente, California with his wife and five kids. So, and we're all Spanish-speaking except my youngest brother. He doesn't speak Spanish. It's funny.
Huh. What do you think kept you in Madison?
Well, alcoholism first. When you're drinking, like I was drinking in the 60s, you can't get it together enough to move away. And I was going to school, of course, all that time, to graduate school, various graduate schools. And then I was working on a degree most of that time. And it was a very exciting time. I mean, it was the anti-war years and the coming out as gay years. And I was having quite a life, despite I wasn't a maintenance alcoholic. I was a periodic, which meant I wasn't drunk all the time by any means. It's just that it happened frequently enough. And then when I sobered up here, and somehow I got involved with somebody who was here, and pretty soon my whole career was here, and I just stayed here. And I 60 miles from where I was actually born, Beloit. Ooh, horrible town, but I didn't spend any time there. Well, my first 3 months, you know. So I came to graduate school here, and that's what happened, actually. And when I came back from the Peace Corps, I continued here in graduate school. And by the time it would have been the time that I would have left, I had gotten a job that became a career. And fortunately, because the benefits have been terrific when I retired, you know, which of course the current administration has been working at getting rid of. But I've been retired 11 years, and I have a wonderful pension, and I have a home, and I have a partner. He's a native Madisonian. He grew up in Old Middleton Road, you know? I mean, actually got me a native, you know? Got me a native. He's very exotic, too. He travels so well. Now, he's been to South America. I don't know how he puts up with me, but he's, you know, we've been to Europe several times. In fact, we're going in July. We're going to Austria and Switzerland. Neither of us has ever really been there. Uh-huh. And he, you know, he eats almost anything, and he doesn't get freaked out by another culture. He gets along, even though he doesn't know another language. And he's been to Argentina to visit my relatives with me, as has my daughter. So I've been very, very lucky. But yeah, it just was happenstance that I came here to graduate school and was one of those people who never left. And my alcoholism kept me here during the decade of the 60s. And then when I sobered up, I was like involved. And there were times I thought of moving to San Francisco and moving to Buenos Aires, but they weren't serious, I don't think. This is home.
You still get the Bay Area Reporter, right?
Oh, yeah, it's right there, the current run, you bet. Well, I still have some very dear friends. The man who picked me off the floor at the university club and gave me my job is one of my closest friends out there. He's the one that sends me the Bay Area Reporter. He's old. He was old when I met him. Well, I thought he was old. He was in his 40s and I was in my 20s. He's in his, what, 80s? And I'm in my 70s. Doesn't somehow seem quite so old. Oh, in those days, I was just embarrassed to be seen with him. You know, he's an old man, and I was this young person. Oh, and I thought, you know, people would think he was paying for me or something. Not that anybody would have paid for it. But who knows? I gave it away. Always gave it away. Very generous. Got that from my mother. The more you give, the more you receive. She was absolutely right.
Gay literature.
Oh, gay literature. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Oh, please. Yeah. Yeah.
You should just read the article that I wrote in the magazine.
Our lives?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. But since we have the recorder going, do you mind?
No.
A little bit?
No.
So how did you get interested in it?
Well, look, in 1970, the only thing you could read in gay literature was a novel where they all died or killed themselves. Or, you know, there was this one book out supposedly by this doctor. He was not a doctor, or if he was a doctor. I can't, the title does not come to mind. I have it, however, in the other room. And it was about being gay and that it wasn't necessarily a disease, but if it was, you were stuck with it. You were going to be that way the rest of your life, so get used to it. And it was the first one that gave a faint hope of, well, this is something that lots of people have. But I started seeing other gay publications or novels, or there'd be a gay character, and I thought, oh, I'm going to collect all the books written about gay people or by gay people. So I started it in the 70s, and then, you know, it didn't take very long for it to dawn on me that I wouldn't have enough room in my house, and there were beginning to be gay presses, you know, and lesbian presses. Not that I was interested much in the lesbian part, but the gay, you know, there began to be these publications, these books, and of all kinds, novels and, you know, fiction, nonfiction, biographies, autobiographies. It was so exciting, and I thought, okay, I can't afford to collect all gay literature, and I can't afford because I don't have enough room in my apartments. At that time, I lived in an apartment. No, I had the house by that time. I can't. What am I going to do? So I thought, I love poetry. I've always loved poetry. And I thought, I will collect all the gay poetry that's either in English or translated from another language into English. And I do have enough room, and I can afford that if I don't buy, you know, like first editions of someone's poetry, like The Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde. I wasn't going to buy a $500 copy of it, but I could buy a paperback with it in, and it's poetry, so what? So I started collecting gay poetry, and pretty soon I had shelves and shelves and shelves of that. And I began to realize it's not safe to have it in this house. It might burn down. It's not, fixed with temperature and humidity and so on to keep books safe. They'll get ruined. And I just don't have enough room. What am I going to do with it? And I thought, well, I'll donate it to a library. And then I thought of gay archives. And then, of course, during that time, when you'd read about a gay archive, next year it'd be gone. Or they'd be having fights and it would fall apart. Or it wouldn't last. And I thought, well, I'm not going to give it to a gay organization. That's ridiculous. But what am I going to give it to? Well, I worked at Memorial Library in the rare books department. And the rare books department, their major collections were small magazines and private presses. What publishes poetry? Private presses and small magazines. Because big presses, I mean, there are some big presses that publish, and there's some major publishers that publish, but only a very few. And especially gay poetry. So I worked at Memorial Library, and they had that in the rare books, and I thought, maybe the rare books department is interested. Well, I went to them, and they pounced on it. They were so excited. I said, well, I have over 1,000 copies of books and manuscripts and so on of gay poetry, and I said, I think it might fit into your collection, and it would be safe there. And they got very excited. They got even more excited when Roy, my friend that I'm talking about, who, you know, gave me that job, and he was a librarian also, but he moved out to Berkeley then, replaced me with an 18-year-old, which he should have, because I wasn't in love with him. But my nose was out of joint a little bit then for a while, but not very long. We became very close friends, and he would come and visit, and he would just come and spend a week in my house reading and not answering the phone and just enjoying himself. It was his way of having a vacation, coming back here. And Roy's 18-year-old, who wasn't 18 by that time, he was dead. In fact, he threw himself off the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge because he was on drugs, and they had broken up. But he loved him. He had loved him so much. And that was the only man he ever really, really, really deeply loved. And he said, Michael, I've been trying to figure out a memorial for him. And I just, you know, what if I donated money for the upkeep of the gay collection, how could we make that into a memorial? I said, very simply, I said, they're going to publish booklets or publish materials about the gay poetry collection, and I said, I will make sure that they attach to it any kind of memorial you care to write about your lover. So he said, okay. So I went to Memorial Library, and I said, well, you know, this friend of mine is going to donate $10,000 and then $5,000 every year from then on for maintenance and continued building of this collection. Oh, did they get excited about that? Money! Because libraries have a terrible time. The expense in a book is not buying the book. The expense is in processing the book and having records of the book, cataloging the book. That's what's expensive. That's why they want to give you charge you $50 for a $5 book that you lost. They don't care about the book, and they don't care that you give them another book that's $5 or more expensive. They care about all the processing that goes on that they have to pay for. So, in fact, I donated that collection to Memorial Library, and they had a big hoo-ha. They had this wonderful tea and crumpets and cookies and cakes and things with silver china and so on, and some very important people from the university. I think there was a, you know, somebody from up the hill there, I read four different poems, and my family was there, and it was very exciting, and they, you know, for the collection.
When was
after,
it?
Hmm?
When was that? Roughly.
Roughly, maybe a decade ago.
Okay.
I've continued collecting. I donated 300 more items and so on, and they've been very good. They've used the money, and they've had them cataloged, and usually have some gay student guy, you know, some library student, who they get to do it, and then they pay him, you know. So it's been very good.
Do you go visit them?
Oh, I do, yeah, all the time, of course. I have to visit them to make sure that they're taking care of it, and, you know, checking up on them. And sometimes I go and look and read some of the poetry in the collection. And I get to go down in the stacks if I want to. They're in locked stacks, you know, sealed stacks. If you were to go, if you were writing a paper and you wanted gay poetry, you know, you would just tell them what author and so on, and they would bring the books up, and you'd have to sit in that little room or
the
whole bit. Big room and, yeah, read them. But, yeah, I go and I talk to them all the time. Barb, I like those people. They're fun, you know, people in the rare books department.
Was Robin Ryder there at the time?
She's still there.
Yeah.
I don't care for her very much. She's who she is, I guess. I don't think she's very interested in I don't think she's very interested in her job. But maybe she is. I don't have anything against her. I just don't find her simpatico particularly. I like most of the other people that work there better.
What four poems did you read and why?
Oh, well, I'll have to look it up, but basically I read one very classical poem. I think it's called The Bugle Boy. I don't know who the author is, but he's a classical author, and one that's not widely known to be gay, but it's actually about a blowjob. But it's, you would never, reading it, neither of you would catch on to that. Even Scott probably might. He's a little gay. So, oh, oh my goodness. I'm being interviewed.
Oh.
These people are telling their whole life. Yeah, I'm telling them all about you. This is Dwayne, my partner. Can you introduce yourself?
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Oh, hi, I know you.
How are you?
I'm good.
Everybody knows Scott.
Whew. Is he giving you lots of good information?
Of course. Anyway. I was just talking about the poems that I read at the, you know, gay poetry collection dedication.
Ah,
remember?
Yes.
So I read that one, that classical one. Then I read one about, basically about AIDS, very sad poem. I don't remember what the third one was, but the fourth one was written by somebody who was really angry, one of the more modern poets, and talked about what he would do to somebody who hurt another gay person. And he really was vicious, and he really said he was the tarantula of your nightmares, and, you know, I'm going to stab you and blah, really get even. And I read that one really loud and really aggressively. I was feeling all those feelings for some reason at that time. So there were four poems, and there were, like, as I said, there was a classical one, and then there was that sad one, and then there was this really vicious, violent one. And I can't remember what the fourth one was, but I got great glee out of it because, you know, they are so proper. I mean, this is, you know, no.
The library staff?
Yes, the library staff, but not even the staff so much as the important people who came to, you know, dignify the proceedings. And I sort of thought, screw you, and dignify these proceedings. I have a tendency to do that. I didn't have a lot of respect, shall we say, for the law. I've been used to lying all the time to legal authorities. You know, in the Peace Corps, they threw several people out who they suspected were gay who weren't.
Wow.
And I escaped the cut, fortunately, because they'd had this wild affair with this woman in college, and that was one thing they came across. And they didn't happen to come across some of the other stuff. I was terrified that they were going to find out. This was 62, you know. And they threw out anybody they thought was gay.
Did you know about the purge that was happening on campus in 62, Mike?
No, I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Dwayne, they're cross-examining me. It's scary.
Good.
My mother didn't know about Kent State, and she was just... a state or two over.
Really?
In college.
Yeah. No, I didn't know about the perch, but I know, you know, like I knew, I'm not going to mention his name, but there was a librarian at the public library who used to go and shill like the police did to catch people who were gay, and he was gay. He could, you know, and because he was afraid that he would be exposed. They've kind of forced him to do it. Isn't that appalling?
Yeah.
Because he was frightened, he exposed other people.
So he exposed other people who were at the library?
Well, no, people who came and used the bathroom to pick up
yeah.
other people.
Yeah.
He'd go dangle his thing, and then he'd tell the police, and they'd come in and ruin that person's life. But not his, of course. He's still around, too. He's a friend, I'd have to say. He's not really an enemy, but it's a sort of a bad thing in his life that he doesn't like to think about. Well, I wouldn't either.
Mm-hmm.
I never was arrested for being gay. I was arrested a couple times for being drunk. I was actually thrown in jail a couple times. Everybody is, isn't they? Aren't they?
Yes. So in terms of, so we're talking about police and gays.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a sense of how that's changed over time? Have you seen that change during your time in Madison?
Well, yeah. I remember when we went out on Picnic Point and we had a baseball, I could care less about baseball, but we had a baseball game between the gays and the police. Can you imagine? That was when What's-His-Face came in.
Cooper
came in during the anti-Vietnam War era when everything was falling apart. I mean, you were terrified of the police then. And the only people you trusted were people who had long hair, quite frankly. Not that I had much long hair, but I mean, you know, you didn't trust the police. They were, you know, the enemy. They were the pigs. And Cooper came in and he changed that.
Not in the sexual sense.
No, not in the sexual sense.
In a bad way.
Well, they might have in the bad way, yeah. Well, you didn't mind going to bed with them, but they didn't offer that very much. Cooper came in, and several years later, I remember going out to Picnic Point, and in that area, we had a baseball game between the gays and the police. It was quite funny, quite interesting. And now, of course, you know, I mean, half of them must be lesbians, you know. I mean, we've got tons of lesbians in the fire department and the police department, so what's there to be afraid of? Well, they're scary, but not to us. Don't be afraid, let me tell you. But things changed. I began, again, my perception of the police didn't have so much to do with being gay. It was that it was illegal, and I was afraid of them for that reason, but no more afraid of them than for any other reason or any other illegal thing I might be up to. It wasn't because I was gay. I never got that feeling. But I didn't trust them because during the anti-war era, or the Vietnam anti-war era, all authority was something we were suspicious of and afraid of and didn't want messing with us, you know. And in big cities like Chicago, or, you know, you're afraid of the police, period, just because they're liable to be corrupt and vicious.
What sorts of things were you doing in the Vietnam War
era?
Activism?
Yeah, activism, demonstrating and covering for people who were doing worse things than the kind of demonstrating we were doing. I never threw any bombs, but, you know, I was involved in a lot of demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, and they were arresting. I never actually got arrested for that, unfortunately. That would have been nice. That would have been at least something good on my record. But I was involved in demonstrations where people were arrested. And, of course, when we went to Washington, they really arrested a lot of people, because we also had those Ho Chi Minh people and a few other really radical leftists who attached themselves to the anti-war demonstrations, and then they would start fights with the police, and then, you know, you'd start running away from them, trying to get away, and you would. I did. But that was mostly because I was in demonstrations, not because I was particularly afraid of the police at other times. I was brought up to trust them. Well, not in Peru, but, I mean, in the States. We thought, you know, somebody you asked directions from and they would give you directions. They were law-abiding. We discovered, of course, many of them are not law-abiding. They are here now, I think. And I think gays get treated well. Not entirely, though. I had one friend of mine who, I don't know, he was caught doing something in the park, and he gave the policeman a blowjob, and the policeman let him go. And I was a little shocked at that. But that was only one policeman. That's not generally what they did. Actually, come to think of it, it might have even been a lesbian.
That was recent?
You had to give him... No, not recent. That was more like maybe 15 years ago. I haven't heard anything bad about policemen these days. And we had a stupid police chief previously, but we have a good one now. And the previous one was only hired because he was black. I guess our current one is black, but he was hired because he's good.
We're nearing the time that we would normally wind down. Are there questions that you two want to ask before we...
Yeah, you've been very quiet.
Yeah, I've been
probably terrified.
I've been mainly the one taking down notes.
I see. That's the one that I can't allow him to leave the house.
There's anything you could say that would be surprising, I think. unless you can think of but
something surprising. Yeah.
On that note, actually, I was thinking, what do you perceive as? I mean, one thing in literature, I was thinking of when you were talking about gay poetry was the sense of gay writers previous who have now written something in a sense being
well a
passed.
Lot of them, of course. Gore Vidal wrote The Pillar and The City in the Pillar, and in his first writing of it, the gay man killed himself,
right?
But he rewrote that later, and he's gay, you know, Gore Vidal is, and he rewrote that later, and the gay man didn't kill himself. So his writing has changed with the times. And he doesn't primarily write gay things. He's written science fiction. He's written historical novels. He's written, he's a marvelous novelist, actually. I've read most of his books. And most of them have nothing to do with being gay. but he did write that one novel. And then this person I was telling you about who wrote The Only Thing, he was a psychologist or psychiatrist supposedly, about gay people and saying, well, you have to learn to live with it. He came out later. He was gay, and he came out later, many, many years later, 30 years later, and wrote another book, which was quite different in its tone about being gay. And many writers, in fact, gay writers, in their later years, if they lived into the 70s and 80s and 90s, that is, wrote then either a gay novel or wrote autobiographical material about themselves that was more real, more, you know.
Gordon Merrick.
Yes.
Isherwood.
Yeah, well, Merrick was trash, but Isherwood was a good writer. Gordon Merrick was sort of like those bodice busters that they write for middle-aged housewives who need a little heating up but don't want to be real dirt.
So I wanted to know what your sense was of, I guess, lineage of gay men, you think, over time, and how do you see your living through it as, how do you, I guess, relate or feel towards young
men? Well, I have a lot of gay men who became very dear to me and part of what I consider my lineage. Like in San Francisco, you know, the one who was killed, who became part of the city council. And I was just looking at his obituary too. And I think I have it. But writers who were really important to me, that one that wrote about films, Russo, people like that just became very important to me because they they were such good people. They did good things, and they became people I admired and respected and wanted to be like. You know, all of our people who have put themselves out on the line and said, you know, this is who I am. And they don't all come to mind, but many of the writers of gay books, I admire them so much. And, you know, the one who founded the Fairy Organization.
Harry Hay.
I mean, I am very far from being a fairy.
The Radical Fairies?
The Radical Fairy. I'm very far from being a member of that subculture. But I'm very proud of them and pleased about them. I mean, they're screaming queens. They're really something. You know, they dress up all the time and run around in the woods either with women's clothes on or no clothes. And some of them are my good friends, actually. And Harry Hay was one of the founders of that. He was also founder of one of the gay organizations, the Mattachins. Did he help found the Mattachins? These are people who really put their life out on the line really early. Yeah, and yet I wouldn't really probably, Harry Hay would not be a friend that I would probably relate to very much. He just died not very long ago. He was in his 90s out in San Francisco. So I was more for the ones who were radicals, who, you know, did things. Like I say, that one in San Francisco, what's his name?
Harvey?
Harvey. Harvey Milk. Oh, my God. I just worshipped him practically. He was really something, you know, and then to be so brutally killed. But Harvey Milk, he was really something. And Russo was too. I just read the biography that came out about him, you know. I have shelves and shelves of autobiographies upstairs. Yeah. So I should get that article.
I'm curious, yeah, that book you mentioned about the psychiatrist.
Oh, I'll find it. Something if it's Homosexual in America.
Homosexual in America.
Oh my goodness, that's so... It's...
Sounds very clinical, doesn't it?
Oh, of course.
And all-encompassing.
Well, yeah. Of course. Oh, you should read... if you take a medical history of sexuality class, reading early 20th century descriptions of homosexuals are really interesting, especially the Germans. Havelock Ellis, Freud, Austrian, but and then there was another, there was an American, but yeah, like the endocrinological studies in the 1930s of the sexual invert and the persistence of that theme, just based upon different mechanisms is very, it's a long living. So, and of course, with the effeminate men, you completely leave out the bear community, even though there are kind of queens. You just have to go beyond the surface features. Right. But the best, gayest music in town is Whoops. Like, it's current, it's trendy, it's way queenier than Plan B. Like, it's amazing. It's so glam.
Like books like this, you know.
Yeah. Oh, which one is it? Oh, Jonathan Katz. Yeah.
But here's The Homosexual in America.
Oh.
And this guy also wrote a book, and then later on he wrote one that revealed his all about his homosexuality.
The best little boy in the world.
Yeah, I don't think it's a very good
John.
I don't like the writing very much. But this, his name, that isn't his name, really.
Oh, Donald Webster.
Yeah, that's a made-up name.
Okay. The Homosexual in America. Right. Is this
a major book?
But I want to show them the alternate. I want to show
Harry
them
Benjamin.
I'll get the poetry.
Okay.
Oh, that's amazing, that
article.
What year is this?
I think 51.
Yeah, 1951, wow. Very interesting. I wish I should have taken my advisor here. She would love, this is some of the stuff she studies. The Treader Collection just had a new discovery. St. Elizabeth's Hospital in D.C., where I think it's the Department of Homeland Security, like they bulldozed the hospital and I think they're building that now. And they discovered this, a janitor was cleaning out old rooms prior to demolition because they had to get rid of all the records before they, you know, which were rotting in boxes and because they didn't want, it's still HIPAA. And he just happened to start going through them, and he also happened to be gay. And he discovered boxes upon boxes of records of homosexual patients who were taken for reparative therapy in like the 30s through the 60s. And those records are known but are almost never in existence. I mean, it's impossible to find them. And so the fact that they were found is amazing. But they're first-hand diaries of patients. There's actual documentation of the procedures that were done as opposed to just the inference from medical journals, because you can only indirectly study, but the actual patient records of not so much lobotomy as more ECT and the hormonal therapies, and it's fascinating. And so, yeah, so he happened to send it to Minnesota, where good faculty are processing. They have to figure out the legality of it. That's going to be an issue, but
right, because some of those people are still alive.
Yeah, and some of them are dead in really awful circumstances, so their families are going to be concerned about that. But it's a gold mine, for sure.
Tara and I got in the same magazine. Is that great?
Yes.
Is this the latest issue?
Oh no, this is 2008. Oh,
okay.
I've written some stuff that got into law publications. There I am. And that's the whole... Actually, you guys can take that with you if you have Scott return it to me at some point. I have several copies. But
I have it in a PDF I will send.
Oh, yeah. I can just download the PDF.
Oh, that's right. Of course. I forgot. You can get everything on the fucking computer.
Yeah, September 2008.
Why
could
you get my whole life on it, for God's sake?
I haven't done the search yet.
Well, if you do the search, my name will bring things up. But the poetry collection will come up because you have to put Flaherty in there. Yeah. / Flaherty, Flaherty. Because James Michael Richard Flaherty was the lover that we wrote the obituary about, that is printed, in fact, on the publication that they have about the poetry collection. Amazing. I don't think I have one of those around, but it was a very nice thing. Mm-hmm. Roy was very pleased. He thought it was an appropriate... That bathroom that you used, you flushed?
Of course.
Yeah, did you look at the little thing, the little plaque on
there? I saw the plaque.
That's Ortopan. That's the friend who gave me the job in the catalog department and who gave the money for the poetry collection. His name is Ortopan, so I called the thing the Ortopanic because he actually donated it to my house for me. He's very sweet. He would come and stay here, and he'd get pissed off that there wasn't a microwave, so he bought me a microwave. He pissed off there wasn't a coffee pot maker, so he bought that. He didn't like it because there weren't the right lamps, so he bought a lamp. He didn't get pissed off because we didn't have toilets. We had those, but I was putting that in. And I thought, Roy donates stuff every time. And so I happened to mention it and how it cost. And he came up with the whole plumbing, all of it, including the toilet.
That's fabulous.
Oh, it was. It was a couple $1,000. Yeah. It's very sweet. The tablecloth on the table is something he...
So,
sweetheart.
Well, I was one thing when you mentioned the goddamn computers. It's,
I'm sorry.
No. I appreciate it. No. It's bad. I grew up before computers.
Yes.
You did. Were functionally literate.
Oh, right.
they were green and black. But
punch cards.
Yeah. Oh, I've not.
No, that was
not so World War II calculating missile targets. No. but what do you think of the generations of folks that have come after you in terms of where we come in your relationship to the
them?
I guess.
Well. They're all lovely, but I lived through my era where I went to bars and danced all the time. And I danced, boy, I danced lots and went to bars. Well, I'm not saying either of you two go to bars.
What were you dancing to? Some of the songs?
Donna Summer, disco. But I danced to Peruvian music and stuff too, but that isn't known. You're talking about the gay era here. It was disco. We danced to boy did we dance to disco. And everything else that came before and after. Up to a point. What I think of gays now, well, first of all, most of my friends are at least in their 30s. And I have quite a few of them that are, in fact, in their 30s and 40s and 50s and on and on. I don't do any online, you know, looking for people. I mean, I've never gone on a chat line. And I just don't do that. So I don't relate to that aspect. You heard what I said about dating sort of nastily, but I didn't really mean it nastily. But I mean, I find it kind of odd that many of your generation, they go on dates, which is fine. But, you know, I never did that. And that was partly because of the way it was then. When you got together with someone, you went to bed with them. Period. Almost inevitably. And then you discovered whether you had anything in common and whether you talked to them the next day or the next week. And it might not be a very good way of going about things, but at least you got something from it. More than you bargained for sometimes. I guess I don't know anybody, except very, very few, gay men or women in their 20s. Do we, Dwayne? Who do we know?
Not a lot. There's got to be a few, but I can't.
Yeah, there's got to be a few. They're around. I used to go to the dances that, what's that organization?
10%.
10%? I admired them so much. I mean, I admired the gays that put it together, and they were in their 20s and 30s. It was young gays. You know, it was university kids. And I really respected and admired and liked it. I liked it that it was there. I mean, I enjoyed going to them occasionally, you know. And I don't know how to answer that question. I like individuals, like either one of you two I could get to be friends with, you know, get to know you, and I would like you. And you're just like anybody else, except you just haven't, I mean, if I say the war, I mean World War II. And you might not cop to that, or you might think it's the Vietnam War. Yeah. Or when I say anti-war demonstrations, I'm talking about the Vietnam War. Stuff like that. There would be things like that that make it a little funny, but it wouldn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. I think that young gays are lucky that they have more to look at when they're trying to come out than, what's his name? The Milwaukee
pianist. Oh,
Liberace. I think they're terribly lucky that they don't have to identify with Liberace to be gay.
Or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, yeah, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Well, that's a very good play.
But the...
I don't know how to answer that question other than, you know, I guess I'm... In a way, I'm out of touch. I don't know any of your generation. I assume you're both in your 20s? Yeah.
19.
Oh, Jesus.
26.
Larry Savitas was 19 when I went to bed for the first time. I was horrified. I was in my 40s. I thought, oh, my God. This is awful. It was actually wonderful, but it was awful because I felt like a dirty old man. So maybe I was. I don't know. I like people, and I don't think I think about them. I don't think about them as younger or older. I just think about them. Are they interesting? Are they doing something like you're doing something interesting? You know. Presumably, you better be careful what you write. What are you taking those notes for anyway?
We have to make an index of the interview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was your last name?
You might have to use the computer.
Yeah,
you probably will use a computer. I mean, you don't write by hand, do you, anymore? Well, you are right now. But you probably write things on the computer, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, you weren't right on a typewriter. Not even me anymore. It's too hard. It's too much work. I had mine all fixed up. I was going to, you know, several years ago, I was going to start typing because that's how I did all of my...
Can you still find the ribbons?
I don't know.
Didn't Kodak go out of business?
Well, you have to really look for them. You can find them online. He always does stuff online. I really do email. And that's about, and of course I look for things on Google. But I don't automatically think like, you know, last night he wrote up a bus schedule for himself to someplace he's going that he didn't know where it was. And I said, oh, how about this dentist that I'm going to? And he printed out a bus schedule for me. I think of calling on the telephone and asking the bus people, which works. They're very good.
They'll go in the phone book.
Yeah.
Maybe to look up a number, or I'm thinking, oh.
Yeah, he goes online. And I'm thinking phone book. Now they don't even do very good phone books, but they have them still.
We used to do the phone book in the city map. And, like, I remember that.
So, Michael, is there anything that you wanted to make sure that you talked about today that you didn't get a chance to?
Oh, Lord. I don't. The thing is, I am so ignorant about, you know, you look back on gay liberation and how that happened. And it was just a gradual process, and I can't. You know, other than telling you I belong to Gay Liberation Front, GLF, which doesn't exist anymore. And there were a couple of other gay organizations, too. I don't feel I'm a very good source for gay history in Madison. You know, I was very involved in all sorts of activities, like the Madison AIDS Support Network. You could be more involved than me. I mean, I was a founder, and I worked in it for 10 years. But it's not something, actually, that I enjoy looking back at those times. It's very hard. And that marked most of us who lived through that era. It really marked us in ways that we don't even know. They say we should all be in the nut house, but we're not, you know. And you guys don't have any experience of that. I mean, all you do is read about it. It's a chronic illness, and, you know, and I hope to God that you're, you know, being safe, because it is not over. It's not gone. And it's just, nobody ever published anything about it anymore. Have you seen anything in the paper in the last few years about AIDS?
Well, yeah. Recently, Truvada being approved, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, no, you have to dig if you want to get clinical information.
Yeah.
New information.
Right.
It's, you know, it's out of the news cycle.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. The only time it's ever really written about is, like, Africa, like you say, you know, then of course it's.
I'm not a good example because I write about AIDS history. Medical AIDS history.
So. Oh, medical history.
But, yeah.
Yeah, well, certainly fascinating because it is just rapidly changing retrovirus and it shifts and all sorts of stuff. Unfortunate.
Well, Michael, is this a good place to end it for today?
Yeah, sure.
We'll probably do follow-up.